afternoon, Met fans, and welcome to another episode of the Terry Collins Show presented by Tunnel the Towers, supporting America's greatest heroes. Donate just $11 per month by going to t2t.org. That's T, the number two, T.org. I'm John Arezzi, and we welcome back the former manager of the New York Mets, the most tenured skipper in the history of the franchise, the analyst for SNY's Baseball Night in New York, Mr. Terry Collins. How are you doing today, Terry?
I'm doing great, John. I'm doing great. It's getting to be to an exciting time of the year. You know, I love free agency. I love the winter meetings. Used to love to go to the winter meetings. And, you know, that stuff's getting close. So even though the action's over, there's a lot more to watch for this winter.
Oh, especially this offseason. There's so much going on. And we're going to get into that. We'll discuss the latest on the Juan Soto chase, the Mets free agents, manager of the year decision went down this week as well. And on Talking with TC, Terry, we have a very cool guest, as we typically do on your show. This week, SNY's TV play-by-play voice of the Mets, part of that trio of Gary, Keith, and Ron. We got Gary Cohen coming on today, so we got another good interview today, Terry.
Yeah, well, I'm very excited about it. You know, Gary's a... First of all, he might be the best in the business play-by-play guy that there is in the game. And to be teamed up with those two guys, they have such a great time in the booth, and they're so fun to work with. You know, in my 7 years there, we formed a great relationship, and so I'm excited to have Gary on today.
Look forward to that for sure. Let's get into the leadoff. It's been awards week in Major League Baseball. Earlier in the week, the Rookie of the Year award was handed out, and the phenom pitcher Paul Skeens of the Pittsburgh Pirates won the National League Rookie of the Year. And then New York Yankee starter Luis Gill won the Rookie of the Year in the American League. But also the managers of the year were selected in the AL and the NL. And in the National League, Milwaukee Brewers' Pat Murphy, first-time manager, won the award, securing 27 out of the 31st place votes. Carlos Mendoza finished third. The Mets manager was also a first-time manager and had an amazing season. In the American League, Cleveland Guardians' Stephen Vogt got the nod, 27 of 31st place votes as well. Terry, your thoughts on the manager of the year voting? Were you surprised that Mendoza actually finished that far behind in the first place tabulation?
I'm shocked. But, you know, first of all, and I know a lot of it is the fact that they had the huge payroll. I got that. I mean, I understand it. But the job that he did from the start, you know, with them getting out of the gate poorly, all the injuries they've had, all of the roster maneuvering they had to do, that he only got one vote, one first place vote. He deserved many more. You know, I talked to lots of writers throughout the summer, and every one of them was raving about what a tremendous job this guy does. So I was a little surprised. I'm not surprised Pat won. He certainly deserved it, you know, taking over a team that really lost one of the best pitchers in the game. And, you know, one of their best players was out most of the year. So, you know, I'm not surprised, but I sure thought Carlos should deserve some more first place votes.
Absolutely did as well. And of course, the voting for these awards, the cutoff date is at the end of the regular season. So nothing that happens in the postseason counts because these votes have already then been tabulated. Terry, we go on this week to a couple of other big awards. Cy Young Award is going to be handed out, and the MVP awards will be handed out as well. Aaron Judge is the overall favorite in the AL, and Shohei Ohtani is expected to beat out Francisco Lindor for the NL MVP. Terry, with Ohtani's 50-50 season, it's never been done before. And it is special, but Lindor, with all he did for the Mets at the plate, on the field, in the clubhouse, his overall season, his clutch hitting, even playing through the injury towards the end of the season, and Ohtani just being a DH, what are your feelings about the MVP, mostly this year, likely going to a designated hitter?
Well, again, you're talking to a guy who is an everyday player. I mean, and there's something – when you put up the numbers that Francisco put up, and you're playing not only every day, but the position that he's playing, which is maybe the most important position on the field, shortstop, and being brilliant defensively, brilliant offensively, brilliant on the base pass. I mean, I hope he garners a lot of votes. I'm not taking anything away from Ohtani. 50-50 is a tremendous thing. But you know what? This guy DH'd and he got it, kept his legs under him. That's why he was able to steal 50 bases, because his legs stayed strong, because he didn't have to go out and run out and play defense. And, you know, and I really understand it when he was pitching, how he could, you know, do both things. And certainly that would, should garner a lot of votes for MVP. But I just think when you do the job that Francisco did this year on a team that, again, when they moved him to leadoff, that team took off, and he pretty much, you're looking at the Los Angeles Dodgers. And again, not, don't take anything away from Shohei, but he's also got two other MVPs sitting in the middle of that lineup. So I think Francisco's really got a good shot at it all.
I certainly hope so. We'll wait and see what happens there. But let's get into the Juan Soto chase. This has been the dominant story in baseball. All the other free agents are there sitting, and there's not a lot of activity right now because everybody wants to know where Soto's going to land, and then I guess the other dominoes will fall. The Mets met with Soto this past weekend. As it's been reported, it went extremely well. It was very detailed. There are a lot of things that are being flying out there, offers, but there have been no confirmed offers that have been made to Soto. Other teams have been meeting with him. Obviously, the Yankees, the Blue Jays have met with him. The Red Sox have met with him. The Dodgers have met with him. And even the Phillies are meeting with him. But for Steve Cohen, and it seems like more than any other player in his tenure as Mets owner, he has been waiting for a moment like this since buying this franchise. So give us your opinion on how far Steve Cohen is going to go. And is this guy and is this free agent the one that he is like, I got to get him?
I would have to say that's probably in his thought process. I got to get this guy. Now, I think there's a lot of things that go into it. And I'm going to tell you that decision, you know, it's pretty hard. You know, these conversations, it's pretty hard to make an offer at this particular moment, because then they shop it. You know, they shop the offer. And you know, it kind of puts the team that makes the first offer really in a tough spot. So, and I know Scott Boras is probably the greatest agent in sports history. And so he's not going to make a quick decision on this. It's going to take some time. And certainly, you know, Juan's made it apparent he's going where the money's going to be. And certainly Steve's got the money. So I think the Mets have a legitimate chance at it. I look at it this way, John. I really feel strongly about this. One thing I don't want to have happen with the Mets, and that is to take a guy like Pete Alonso, who's meant so much to the Mets since he's been in the big leagues, what he's done in the city of New York, what he means to the ball club, to have him sit on the sidelines and wait to see what happens with Soto before you do anything with Pete Alonso. I don't think that's fair for Pete. So I sure hope that there is discussions going on to retain Pete Alonso, because I think he's a huge part of that club.
Yeah, it would be a shame if Pete Alonso goes elsewhere. So this chase will continue for Soto. People are saying it could wrap up by the baseball winter meetings. We'll have to wait and see. But the Mets have so many decisions to make this offseason with half their roster being free agents.
The one thing about the winter meetings, that's a great place to have a spectacular announcement, because everybody's there. It's, you know, all the writers are there, all the TV networks are there, all the sports networks. I mean, so I wouldn't be at all surprised if something doesn't pop out at the winter meetings.
Yeah. Let's get to the three qualifying offers that the Mets made. All three turned them down. Pete Alonso obviously turned down their qualifying offer, as did starter Sean Manaea, Luis Severino. Those qualifying offers were $21 million. You've expressed your opinion today on Alonso and Manaea and Severino. How far should the Mets go to bring these two pitchers back? They were such an important part of this team.
They're a huge part of the team. But it's, again, you know, John, you're looking at a guy like Severino. Would he pitch more innings than he's ever pitched before? So, you know, and he's going to be a year older. You know, how's his body going to react to that? Those are all decisions. But, you know, those guys, nobody's surprised when you turn down, those qualifying offers, because these guys want, you know, multi-year deals. So, you know, you might get but I don't know how many years, but I'm guessing each guy's probably going to want 3 years. And maybe they'd settle for two if the money's right. I have no idea. That was one of the things that when I was in the game, I tried to stay out of was the money issue because, you know, agents, they're amazing people. And if they do a good enough job, you know, they're going to get their client paid. And I certainly understand that's what the game's about. And for me, I hope every player gets the most he can ever make. So, but it'll be interesting to see, because one thing the Mets do need is starting pitching.
Yeah, they have to definitely fill the spots that are open right now. And we'll wait to see what happens as we get closer to the baseball winter meetings. And Terry, as we head towards December, the Tunnel to Towers Foundation is rushing to pay off more than 24 mortgages. By the end of the year, the foundation will have delivered more than 200 homes to Gold Star and falling first responder families, as well as catastrophically wounded service members. It's a first responder or service member is killed in the line of duty and leaves behind young children, Tunnel to Towers will pay off their mortgage. The foundation is also showing its support for veterans facing hardships. Over the past 6 weeks alone, they've broken ground on 4 new veterans villages. Since starting its homeless vets program more than a year ago, T2T has provided permanent, stable housing for 10,000 veterans who were facing homelessness. Terry, this week right here in the town that I live in, Franklin, Tennessee, there will be a groundbreaking for 3 mortgage-free smart homes. I will attend that event before heading to New York for Thanksgiving. Those homes will be for Army Sergeant Kevin Gaston, USMC Corporal Travis Dotson, and USMC Lance Corporal Eli Tice. Now, you've attended groundbreaking events in Florida for a veterans village in Bradenton. So these ceremonies are very special. So collectively, Terry, we do give thanks this year to Tunnel to Towers.
Yep. We've talked about it many times, John. They are, without a question, one of the greatest foundations in the country. And what they do for the first responders and those fallen servicemen, it saves families. It keeps them together, and they deserve a lot of credit for, you know, keeping this country together.
Yeah, it'll be my first one attending this week here in Franklin, right here in my hometown. I'm going to go to it and see this, and I can't wait to experience it and see the looks on those soldiers' faces. We will be back with a special Talking with TC right after this word from Tunnel to Towers.
I'm John Crankshaw, a.k.a. Crank. I was blown up by a suicide bomber. You can survive with PTSD and get by, but it does something to your psyche, man. I had a mental breakdown. Tunnels to Towers hooked me up with the resources that I needed. I'll advocate for this to the day that I die, because it saved my life.
By giving $11 a month, you're joining our mission to eradicate homelessness amongst our nation's veterans. Go to T2T.org to make a positive impact.
Today on Talking with TC, our special guest has been with the New York Mets organization since 1989, starting off in the radio booth where he spent 17 years before getting appointed in 2006 to move over to SNY, where for 18 seasons he's been part of a team many consider MLB's best TV broadcast group. Along with Keith Hernandez and Ron Darling, the team of Gary, Keith, and Ron are simply the best there is. He was a 2023 inductee into the Mets Hall of Fame. It's great to welcome, for the first time on Talking with TC, Gary Cohen. Gary, welcome to the Terry Collins Show.
Well, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Gary, thanks for coming on. I know it's I know you're busy with the basketball and stuff, so we'll try to get this quick. And but you know, you can't talk Mets without talking to Gary Cohen about, you know, your knowledge of the history of the Mets, plus your, you know, your passion of being a fan of the Mets. So, you know, as I've talked to several people this summer, I think I want to start out by, first of all, tell me your impressions of this past season. It was unbelievable at the end, but how was it, you know, from start to finish in your eyes?
First of all, before I talk about the team, I've got to talk about how surreal this is, Terry, because for 9 years, I sat in your office every day asking you questions. And now here we are with you asking me questions. I want to tell you, it's very weird for me. I don't know if it's weird for you too.
When I first started, it was, Gary, but you know, after 35 shows, it's gotten a little easier, but
The season was, it was phenomenal. I mean, the first 2 months, everything that could have gone wrong for that team went wrong. You could see that the talent was there. You didn't know if they had enough starting pitching, but you felt as though the lineup was good enough. And, you know, you didn't know about the bullpen. Arms started going down. Brooks Raley got hurt and Drew Smith got hurt. And you just didn't know if it was all going to work out. But I think there was a certain infusion of energy that happened over the course of May with Mark Vientos coming up for good and Jose Iglesias joining the team. And I think that those things really seem to help point the team in the right direction. But I think, and you know how this works, right? The most important thing that you can get as a manager is length from your starting pitchers. And once that started happening, once Sean Manaea and Luis Severino and David Peterson joining the rotation at the beginning of June, all those guys started kicking into gear. You had an idea that it was possible for this team to succeed because, again, they had the offensive talent. Francisco Lindor is not going to hit 180 all year. You know, Jeff McNeil is not going to hit 220 all year. And it happened, right? I mean, Nimmo had the great hot streak before the All-Star break, and McNeil was great coming out of the All-Star break, and Lindor was just fantastic for the last 4 months of the season. And so it all came together because of an infusion of new energy, but also because the guys who were there played up to their potential in a way that they hadn't for the first couple of months.
You know, Gary, that's obviously, as a manager, you know, one of the things, anytime you leave your house and you're on your way to the ballpark, you have to have an idea of what you're going to, what to expect out of your players. And when they don't come through, and I've said it for years, you know, especially when you're a good team, your good players have to play good. You can't, you know, there's going to be a surprise in every team. And I've said it for a long time. There might, you know, a surprise might be, you know, Pete Alonso, who's a great player. He might hit 62 homers. You know, that's a surprise. But in order for them to win, there's got to be a surprise. And I thought the same thing. I thought Vientos coming up and playing like he did, which, by the way, I tipped my cap to him because he, after not making the club in spring training, after a good spring, you know, he could have been down in the dumps, but he didn't. He went down and worked hard and got back and got up and played great. But those other guys, those intangibles that, you know, the guys that came in and added to it. And, you know, I watched a lot of the games, obviously. I watched a lot and, you know, I heard a lot of your broadcasts. But you guys talked about the cohesiveness of that club, not only on the field, but behind the scenes. And I thought that made a big impact in that whole team.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that is so interesting to me about team construction is that you can bring guys in who have good reputations for character and being good teammates and good clubhouse guys. And I think David Stearns did a great job of doing that. Everybody who he brought in was just phenomenal in terms of their makeup. But you don't know how a team's going to mesh. Even if you bring good guys in, they're not necessarily going to be on the same page. And you know how it works. It's an intangible thing that you can't predict. You can put the pieces in place, but you don't always know that they're going to mesh the way you want them to. And, you know, even later in the year when they brought in like Jesse Winker and Ryan Stanek and Phil Maton, I mean, these were all guys who just fit perfectly with the flow of this team. But, you know, I think Carlos Mendoza gets a huge pat on the back for the job that he did keeping things together. You know, when I remember when Carlos was introduced as the manager, people asked me, you know, how do you think he's going to do? And, you know, I barely knew Carlos. But the thing that I said was you find out, especially in New York, about whether a guy is going to be a good manager the first time that crisis hits, the first time that stuff goes wrong. And, you know, here he lost his best starting pitcher basically a week into spring training. The team gets off to a miserable start, and he kept the same demeanor the whole time. Just encouraging, disciplinarian when he needed to be, just held the whole thing together. That, plus the leadership of Francisco Lindor, who to me took another huge step forward this year in terms of his maturation, not just as a player, but as a guy who can be a cohesive force in that clubhouse. So I think those things really helped during the bad times and got them to the good times.
You know, Gary, I think there's got to be someplace, because when you say you bring in good guys, and you, believe me, I've been on teams that have had really nice guys, but there's got to be somebody in there who kind of directs the saying, hey, here's how we're going to play here. And you either buy into it or we'll, you know, we'll find you, be able to get you out of here. And I always thought those were the, on the good teams that I've been around, there were those guys in that clubhouse. You know, when I was in New York, obviously David Wright's demeanor, the way he respected the game, respected the fans, respected the media, you know, hey, look, this is how, and when he got named captain, this is how we're going to do it here. And you either bought in or, you know, David diplomatically went about it the right way, saying, you know, it might be time to find somebody else that's going to fit that bill. And I think you're right. I give Carlos a ton of credit. I talked to him, you know, a number of times during the season, and you're right. He kept that positive, upbeat attitude. And I think that had a huge influence, especially on some of the veteran guys after that slow start.
Yeah. And then the players kind of took it on themselves. They had that very famous team meeting at the end of May after the Dodgers swept them and the glove was thrown into the stands. And you saw who stepped forward, right? It was Lindor, but it was also Brandon Nimmo, and it was J.D. Martinez and to a lesser extent, Sean Manaea and Luis Severino. I mean, there were enough veterans on that team, guys who had been through the wars and understood what was lacking. And, you know, they really made a point of saying, we're going to pay attention to detail. We're going to discuss what is lacking. We're not going to be afraid to call out teammates if we see something that's lacking. And, you know, honestly, Terry, in an era where sometimes you don't get full effort every day, I think this was a team that gave you full effort every day. I mean, just, you know, just the 90 feet from home to first base, it was never lacking. You look at again, I go back to Iglesias. This guy was 35 years old, hadn't played in the big leagues the year before, and he came in with the attitude of a rookie. He never gave you less than full effort, and you know the number of infield hits he beat out attests to that. But it became a team-wide phenomenon, and they really did hold each other accountable. And I think the proof is in the pudding that, you know, from June 1st to the end of the year, they had the best record in the majors.
You know, Gary, I all the years you were there, is there a team you can compare this one to that you saw?
You know, that's an interesting question. I think the you know, the late 90s, early 2000s teams were a little bit different. They had a little bit more of an edge to them, but they also had the big superstar in Mike Piazza, who was a great player, but and a terrific person in his own right, but wasn't really that galvanizing force in the clubhouse. But you know, you had guys like Robin Ventura and John Olerud and Todd Zeal and those guys. But it was a different group, and the same thing with the 2006 team that was. It was such a talented team, but, you know, Wright and Reyes were young players on that team, and they really hadn't, David hadn't, although he was a tremendous influence on that team, he hadn't really taken over that clubhouse the same way. I compare it in some ways more to your 2015 team because you had the influx of talent that changed the dynamic as the season went along. Right. I mean, you know, mm-hmm. You brought in Cespedes and you brought in Kelly Johnson and Juan Uribe and Tyler Clippard and Addison Reed. And you got David and Travis d'Arnaud back from injury. And that sparked the team in early August that year that really took off. So, you know, I think that's probably the closest comparison that I can remember.
Yeah, a lot of people have brought that up on the 20th, but that's what it takes, you know. It's one thing to have energetic young players on your team. It's another thing to have seasoned veterans who, like we had in 15, when you brought Kadire was here and, you know, Uribe and Kelly Johnson. Hey, look, you look down that bench and you had some weapons, man. And you know, with guys who had great confidence too. And I thought, you know, one of the things that I thought the Mets did this year is they brought in guys that knew, you know, could play, knew how to play, and bought into the whole system. And I thought that really made a difference going in.
Yeah. And I think also, you know, you think about that 2015 team going down the stretch, you had guys who were used to playing a lot, who weren't playing every day, and you need to get buy-in from those guys. And I think that happened on this team too. A guy like Tyrone Taylor, who, you know, was in a subsidiary role, but was completely comfortable with it and was always ready to play. And then as the season moved along and he came down the stretch into the postseason, he wound up being an everyday player. But everybody was accepting of their role, even though they might have wanted to be in the lineup every day. They handled it. And you go back to Vientos, who you mentioned, you know, he was completely jerked around, and not the organization's fault, but the year before he had come up and not really played regularly. Then he thought he was going to have a job coming out of spring training, and then they signed JD Martinez, and now he doesn't have a job. And then they bring him up in April, and he hits a big home run, but he gets sent right back down again. And he never lost his edge, and he really performed well when he was sent down, which you don't always see. He took the right attitude, and the improvement of that player from the start of the season to the end of the season was really palpable, and I think that really paid off in a really tremendous performance by Mark in the postseason. And to me, he's now established himself as a budding superstar in this league.
You know, Gary, being around the team like you are, you know, you're on the planes, you're on the, you know, you're in clubhouses. What expectations did you have going into this winter? Do you think, I mean, we can forget Soto, but I mean, I'm looking at Manaea and Severino and, you know, Pete Alonso. Is your take that there's a good shot those guys are going to come back to the Mets? Cause they all seem like they all said, hey, look, we want to be here.
You know, it's interesting. I was listening very carefully after the last game that they lost to the Dodgers at some of the things that were being said in the clubhouse. And I think there's a realization that when you have as many free agents as the Mets had going into this offseason, that there were going to be significant changes. And I think everybody knows that. I mean, they've already made one change as we sit here. You know, Harrison Bader was a free agent. They've now replaced him with Jose Siri, which makes it pretty doubtful that Bader would be back. You know, Alonso is obviously an interesting case because of his age and because of the position he plays, but also the tie that he has with the Mets and the fan base and how valuable he is to the Mets, perhaps more valuable than he is to another franchise. You know, Manaea and Severino rebuilt their careers here and obviously would love to be back. But, you know, not everybody's going to be back. And that's why I think there was a lot of sadness in that clubhouse, even though they accomplished so much in getting to the sixth game of the National League Championship Series. I think they all had a realization that this really special group, while, you know, many of the pieces will be back in 2025, that a lot of them won't be, and that the roster construction is going to be a little bit different, and that room is going to be that much different. And that the question becomes, can the people who laid down the makings of a culture in this season, the Lindors, the Nimmos, can they maintain that with a new group? And, you know, whoever is in that clubhouse, whether it's Juan Soto or some guy you pick up as a minor league free agent who winds up being a big piece for you, can those guys create the same kind of magic? And you just never know until you get there.
Well, that's true. And that's what's, you know, that's what used to be the fun part of the winter was, you know, paying attention to what's going on, but you and I both know when you have Scott Boras as your agent, he's not going to sign fast. I mean, he's going to milk every minute that he can of the whole thing. So I think it's going to be a long winter to see where all those pieces fall.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, the NBA does it so differently, right? They have free agency and it all comes down in 48 hours and everybody signs and it's all over. Here we sit for months and we speculate and we make lists and we go through them. And I can only imagine what, the general managers and presidents of baseball operations go through as they try and sift through all these pieces and try and put the puzzle pieces together and prioritize this guy and but have this this idea in reserve and what are our trading pieces and how much money do we have to spend. The nice thing for Met fans is to know that if it comes down to dollars, that their guy has the most dollars. So that's not a bad thing.
It can only be a bad thing. Yeah. You know, when John introduced you, he brought up your working partners, Gary and Keith. I mean, Ron and Keith. You know, Gary, without a question, I mean, I was a part of it, but, you know, I didn't get to hear you when I was managing, but I've heard you for the last 5 years now or 6 years, you know, every night. Tell us how that blend got to work. Those three personalities have made you guys have, now, from the outside, it may not be true on the inside, but it looks from the outside you guys have more fun in the booth than any of the other broadcast teams that I listen to at all.
Well, I think it comes from a lot of places. I think, first of all, you have to give great credit to the folks who own the Mets, both the Wilpons and now Steve Cohen, and the folks at SNY, in that they've given us latitude to really go wherever we feel we need to go. And that means being honest and it means having a good time. And I think we, you know, every broadcast has lines that they can't cross. And I think they're unspoken, but I think we know where the lines are. And sometimes we push the envelope a little bit, but you have to give credit to the people who employ us that give us the latitude to do that. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that when Keith and Ron and I first started in 2006, we were all pretty much flying blind. I mean, I had done radio my entire life and I had been a real radio chauvinist and I had no intention of going into television. But, you know, I had kids to put through college. And so it seemed like the right thing to do to take the television gig. Keith had kind of dabbled for a few years. He'd done a few games every season, but he hadn't really taken it seriously. And Ronnie had done 1 year in Washington the year before, but he really hadn't had a lot of direction. He was hired the day before the season started, so he was kind of flying by the seat of his pants. So I felt as though we all kind of needed each other. It's kind of like we were all blind in a dark room and we needed to hold hands to guide each other. And then the other factor is that we have had the same producer for the 19 years that we've been together. Greg Picker is just, he's phenomenal. And he knows the game. He gets bored, so he doesn't like to have the same broadcast every day. He's got a great sense of humor. He's very creative. And it's allowed us to push each other to places we didn't know that we could go. And I think having partners in this business is all a matter of knowing who you're working with, where their soft spots are, and hitting them where they live, right? I mean, I know that I can tease Keith in a certain way because he's got the perfect personality and he's going to take what I push him on and run with it and make it more interesting and humorous and insightful than it was before. I know Ron's intellect and how closely he follows the game and how I can push him on those kind of areas. It's been a fantastic partnership. We really do have an enormous amount of fun. We plan almost nothing about what we do. We let the game take us the places it takes us. And honestly, we let the season take us as well. You know, it's funny. People ask me all the time. They say, you must have had a great time this year because the team was so good. And I say, yeah, it was great covering a team that was playing so well. But honestly, we sometimes do our best work when the team stinks, because we have, we can ignore the game a little bit more. Whereas in a season like this, we're very vigilant about being right on top of everything that's happening, because it means so much. But what's amazing to me is that we've actually kept our crew together for almost 20 years now. And that's very rare in this business.
It is, and Gary, I will tell you, because I was there when it all happened, but the development of Steve Gelbs with your guys' help has been amazing. I mean, I was there when, his first day on the job, I was managing, and you guys have made this guy, I mean, he is fun. He is funny to be around. You never know what you guys are going to do during a broadcast with him or something else. And that's where I think the fans get so entertained. I mean, yeah, they watch the games, but you guys bring in the whole outside stuff and not just what the action on the field. And I think it's a lot of fans. I mean, I sit here and every time I go play golf and there's a huge, Mets contingent down here, and all they talk about is your guys' broadcast. Did you see the game last night? Did you hear Gary ask Steve Gelbs to do this? I mean, I think you guys have done a great job of developing Steve.
Well, I give Steve an enormous amount of credit. I mean, he was put in an impossible situation when he joined us. He was replacing the greatest sideline reporter in the history of televised sports, who, Kevin is now, the lead voice of Fox and does Super Bowls. And I mean, that's how great Kevin was, and we were lucky to have him as long as we did. But, for Steve, that was a very difficult situation that he was put in. And, it took a couple of years for him to find his niche. And that's hard, right? Because that job, I don't think I could do that job. I mean, you're sitting there for the entire game. You have to pay attention to the game. You've got your pre and post game responsibilities. But then every once in a while, bam, we're going to you for 20 or 30 seconds of something that you need to get out in concise fashion while still paying attention to what's going on the field, and then deal with our Michigas going back and forth. It is a very, very hard job to do. And it took a couple of years for Steve to get comfortable doing it. But since he has been such an enormous asset to our broadcast, especially, in games that are dragging a little bit. We can bounce stuff off him. He has a great sense of comedic timing and a terrific sense of humor. And we've gotten there with him, and it's been just wonderful. And he deserves all the credit for that. He really had to go through some difficult times to get there, but it's working really, really well.
Well, you guys have lead him down the right path, because I tell you, it's entertaining to watch. So, well, Gary, I know John's got several questions for you. He's been listening to you probably since the day you started. He's been a Mets fan that long, and so I'm sure he's got some great questions for you.
I'm so sorry, John.
Yeah, I go all the way back to 66 at my first game, so I've seen it all. But this is a pleasure, really, an honor to talk to you, Gary. I often ask guests when they come on the show on Talking with TC to share their favorite Terry Collins story or memory. So what's yours?
Oh, I mean, my favorite memory of Terry is not one that I shared with him, but the video that everybody has seen of him and Tom Hallion. I mean, let's be honest. This is one of the classics of the genre. And I know that Terry did not love the fact that it came out when it did, but man, it just showed you in all your glory about how important defending your players and sticking up for them was. And I just thought it presented you in such a positive light. And it let everybody in the world know just how passionate and how caring Terry was. The other thing that we did go through with him was the agonizing last few innings of Johan Santana's no-hitter. That was... I mean, the drama that was involved, not just in the performance of the player on the field, but of the agony that the manager was going through pitch by pitch and inning by inning, knowing that that pitch count was going up, knowing what his physical condition was, knowing how difficult it was for him to stay there with him and allow him to accomplish this incredible feat that nobody had in 50 years in a Mets uniform. To me, that was great human drama. And it was some of the best television we've ever seen.
Yeah, I totally agree. And earlier when we started the show, one of the first guests that we had was Hallion to reunite Terry and Tom and do a watch along of that ejection and the ass in the jackpot. You got to give us a shot. And Terry, you brought up on our last episode on how that was the first time you guys ever had a chance to really discuss that in public or in private.
You know, actually, it's really amazing after that happened. You know, we didn't have Tom as an umpire. We never had his crew after that. And so that was the first time I got to talk to him. But, you know, unfortunately, it got blown up pretty big. But it's still today. I went last night to we have a fantasy camp going on down here. And if I heard one, I heard it 50 times. You got to give us a shot. So.
that'll live forever. Yep. Those clips went viral for us, and you know, you're talking about hundreds and hundreds of thousands of views and impressions on that. So that was a very special moment. That was what a great memory. But Gary, you do go back as a boy growing up in Queens, and I'm sure you spent many an afternoon or an evening at Shea Stadium when you were sitting in the upper deck. Who's your favorite Mets player as you were growing up? And was Shea Stadium at that time and a career with the Mets always your end goal as a kid?
Well, my first goal was to be the shortstop for the Mets, but complete lack of talent precluded that. My second goal was to be a power forward for the Knicks, but I didn't grow quite enough. So, my favorite player as a kid was Bud Harrelson. I always loved watching him. I mean, he was the little guy. He was a spectacular defender. I loved Buddy. And I obviously got to know him as a person, as a coach, as a manager, as a human being, one of the most wonderful human beings I've ever met. And I felt so good about the fact that when I did grow up and meet my childhood hero, that he turned out to be as wonderful as I hoped that he was. And I always wore the number 3 when I played basketball in high school because I was for Buddy. You know, I didn't know that baseball was going to be my future. I once I got to college and started doing college radio, I thought that maybe I could make it in this business, but I never saw myself as a baseball broadcaster because I felt as though I was more in tune with calling action sports, you know, doing basketball, hockey, stuff like that. In fact, when I first started out doing baseball in the minor leagues, I was really daunted by the idea of you know, filling all those innings and baseball is so different from every other sport in terms of the way you broadcast it, because it's a 3-hour game with 8 minutes of action. And so you've got 2 hours and 52 minutes every night to make a jackass of yourself. And I didn't know if I was comfortable doing that, but after a few weeks of doing minor league baseball, I realized that it was something that I really, really loved. And then the aspiration was to get to the big leagues. I wouldn't have cared where. I was just so fortunate that I was able to get the job doing my childhood team. So it was, you know, if I'd gone anywhere else, I would have had to study and learn and become a part of that fan base and understanding what that organization was all about. Here I came with you know, a lifetime full of knowledge and understanding about what Met fans are all about and what the Mets have represented. And it's really a blessing.
So you grew up listening to Bob Murphy. And then in 1989, you know, here you go. You're in the booth and your broadcast partner is Bob Murphy. Tell us about that impact of what he had, you know, as an aspiring broadcaster and the feeling you got when you actually paired with Bob in the broadcast booth, and give us maybe your favorite memory of Bob Murphy.
Well, I mean, I grew up listening to Bob and Lindsey Nelson and Ralph Kiner. They were the only three voices of the Mets for the first 18 years, radio and television. So, I mean, their voices are imprinted into my brain. In fact, when Murph and I first started working together, I did not realize how much of his style and his pacing and his verbiage had seeped into what I do. And I realized, you know, after sitting there for a few weeks working together, and how much he had influenced me without me even realizing it. But my greatest Bob Murphy moment came the first day that I met him. I filled in doing a game in 1988, the year before I started. It was just for one game. Gary Thorne was doing the Mets at the time, and he was also doing the New Jersey Devils, and the Devils were in the playoffs, so he missed a few games, and they used a variety of people to fill in, and not one of them. And I was obviously incredibly nervous, and we were in the pregame portion of the broadcast, and Murph asked me to do the starting lineups. And so I read the starting lineups, and then I froze. I didn't know what to do. I just had no idea what I was supposed to do next. And I was literally frozen with fear. And Murph reached out and he patted my hand and he started talking, and then all the nervousness dropped away. And we did the game together. And then that winter, I wound up getting the job. So it was a great act of kindness. And I'll never forget that as long as I live.
What an incredible voice he was for the New York Mets over their history. And you know, you've carried the tradition on in your own style with Gary and Keith. And I know at the end of a long season, you guys are kind of like, all right, it's over finally. And this season was a special one for sure. Do you guys stay in touch during the off season? I know recently Keith Hernandez lost his beloved companion of so many years, Haji. And of course, everybody knew who Haji was over the course of the years, listening and watching the SNY broadcast. But do you stay in touch with the guys during the off season? And did you reach out to Keith, or did you speak to him after the loss of Haji?
Yeah, I mean, we text a lot, especially during the postseason. You know, we'll be watching the games and texting each other about stuff that happens. And yeah, I had heard about Haji when it happened. And, you know, Keith also had surgery that week. He had hip surgery. So, so I was definitely in touch with him. And, you know, we don't see each other regularly during the offseason. We see plenty of each other during the season. But we're, you know, we drop each other a text or a phone call now and then just to, you know, to catch up and see what's going on. But, it was a shame. I mean, Haji had a fantastic life. I mean, 22 years for a cat is just an amazing lifespan. So
that is a long run.
Yeah. And we, I understand it fully. And we have we have dogs, and one of our Great Danes is almost 13 years old, which is a stunning age for that size dog. And, you know, so we've been kind of guiding her through hospice the last few months. And so it's hard to lose a pet. It's hard to lose a close pet who's been a companion for that long. But unfortunately, unless you have turtles or parrots, we tend to outlive them.
I got one more for you, and then we have a couple of fan questions. And my question for you is, like, it was such an exciting season, and the fans get so accustomed during the during the season to hear their broadcasters. And then you go to the postseason and it's national telecast. And it loses to the fans who will follow that team. It loses its flavor a little bit. So many times you kind of, you know, then you sync up the radio broadcast and try to listen to that while you watch the game on TV. Do you think that MLB during the postseason, like the championship series, the World Series, should incorporate more of the local broadcasters when their team is in these postseason matchups? Like even one of you guys on each team, maybe to be in the booth. What's your opinion on that?
Well, that would be fantastic. I mean, I knew when I took this job, when I moved from radio to TV, that the one downside of it was going to be that postseason wasn't part of the deal. And it stinks. I mean, and every TV broadcaster will tell you the same thing. It's terrible. It's like you've taken a cross Atlantic ship journey, and then you get dumped overboard a mile from shore. It's terrible. You know, one thing that college basketball has done that maybe MLB might be inclined to incorporate is having an alternative channel with local broadcasters. I don't know if that's something that the national broadcasters would ever want to do, but it's bad. And that's no knock on the national broadcasters. I mean, Joe Davis is fantastic, and you know, Adam Amin, and there's so many good young Jason Benetti. There's so many good young broadcasters who are doing a fantastic job. But I understand for the local fans, it's not the same, and for us, it's awful. I mean, I had a good time doing the pre and post game shows on SNY in the studio with Gary Apple and Todd Zeal, but it's not the same as being there and calling the game. The one good thing about it, though, and you mentioned syncing up the radio, I think it gave Howie Rose a chance to really shine for the fans this postseason, and I think that's great. You know, Howie is so wonderful at what he does, and he's such a good friend, and it put him more in the spotlight, and I really like that a lot, because he deserves that kind of notice. And I think that the one thing that is the silver lining in all this is that the local radio broadcasters get a chance to be front and center and have their calls immortalized, and how he did such an amazing job in all of that. So that's the one good thing about it.
Yeah, and he had that opportunity to have some amazing historic calls like you did as well over the course of the season. But we've had Howie on a couple of times, and it's always a pleasure to hear his stories like that as well. All right, we'll get to a few fan questions, and we really appreciate your time. I'll get fan question number one pulled up here. And this comes from our Instagram account, and it's a question that comes from Christian Barroso. Gary, from 0-5 to OMG, that was one of the greatest calls of the season. What was your favorite moment or call of this magical season?
You know, I think I go back. There were two games that I thought were really pivotal coming down the stretch of the season. The first one was in late August in Arizona. If you remember, the Mets had lost a game where Corbin Carroll had a grand slam off Edwin Diaz, and Diaz had given up another big home run in San Diego earlier in the week to Jackson Merrill, and the Mets had lost both those games. So the day after the Carroll home run, Diaz comes back out. It's a day game. And it's almost as though that game was the most important game in making sure that the Mets would thrive in September, because Diaz came out through all fastballs and really reestablished himself and got at least a piece of his confidence back. And I thought I said it in the court that this might be the most important inning for the Mets all season. and he did an amazing job, got the save, and really was phenomenal after that coming down the stretch. So there was that one. The other one was the game in Toronto where Bowden Francis no-hit the Mets for the first eight innings, and then Lindor hit the home run in the ninth, and they went out and scored six runs. That was really a foretelling of what the last game in the last day in Atlanta was going to be like, and what the postseason was going to be like for Lindor. Those were some of the big. And of course, that game in Atlanta. I mean, the twists and turns in the last two innings of that game, with Diaz not covering first base, and then Lindor hitting the home run, and then Diaz comes back out for the ninth, and they clinch a postseason berth. That was pretty amazing.
The second question is a good segue from this one. It comes from Matt Ward from our X account.
Gary, I know Matt.
Ever been a, you know Matt
Oh,
Ward?
Yeah, I know Matt. He's a great radio broadcaster.
Yeah. Oh, okay. He submitted a question, and it's like, has there ever been a player more enjoyable to watch than Francisco Lindor? He seems to just play the game with such joy.
You know, I ran out of adjectives for Lindor this year. I mean, not just the fact that he played so well after getting off to such a poor start, and played with such a great confidence, but that after he got hurt, that he was able to come back and not only get huge hits, but to do it in a way that it reminded me of Barry Sanders running for a touchdown and handing the ball to the official rather than spiking it. It's almost as though he expected to do it, and he ran around the bases with no histrionics. And I don't know if that's because his back was hurting him and he couldn't afford to jump around too much, or if he just was in that zen place that players get into sometimes. But he was just a joy. And the fact that he had such big moments to end the regular season against the Phillies, and I mean, it was great. And I was so happy for him because, you know, his first year in New York was not easy. And it reminded me very much of Carlos Beltran's first year in New York, where it just took a while for a guy who was just enormously talented and so gifted to come from a small market and find his niche. And over the last 3 years, Francisco has taken those steps forward every year and gotten better and better and better as a player and more mature as a person and a leader. And just the whole package, it's just been really extraordinary to watch.
Certainly was. We have one final question for you. This comes from Jeff Cohen, no relation, also from our X account. Gary, Keith Hernandez wrote a book. Ronnie Darling has written three. Will there be a Gary Cohen book in your future?
No. It's hard for me to write an email of more than one paragraph. I make my living speaking. If someone wanted to do an as told to and ask me questions and make a book out of that, I could probably do that, but I cannot sit and write. It's not my thing. I've been asked a number of times about it, and it's just not something I am inclined to do. So I'll have to let
That's what they make ghostwriters for.
Well, I guess. I'm not sure I'd be so thrilled with that either. Exactly. I have voiced an audiobook though for other people, so I guess that'll have to do.
Okay. There you go. Well, we appreciate your time. I'm going to throw it back to Terry. Thank you.
Yeah, that was great, Gary. You know, I get a lot of people asking me, you know, why don't you write a book? I said, you know what? It's just not who I am. I just, you know, I lived it. I don't need to, you know, I don't think it's that great to share it with somebody. I mean, have a conversation is one thing, but it's hard. But listen, I want to thank you.
I don't even tweet, so.
Yeah, you know. Well. I don't either. But, you know, matter of fact, it's all I can do to send texts back. So it's hard.
There you go.
Anyway, I know you're busy. Thank you so much, Gary, for being on today. You know, like I said in the beginning, you can't have a Mets broadcast without having Gary Cohen on it. So I appreciate your time today and look forward to seeing you in the spring. If I could listen to those basketball games, I'd love to, because you got one of the great voices and great energies. That's how I always thought, you know, anytime I've ever heard you, you know, watch the games and stuff, it's the passion and the energy and your love of what you do is what I think makes you great. So thanks for coming on today.
Well, Terry, thank you. I don't know how you feel, but I had so much fun working with you for all the years we were together when you were managing the Mets, and those conversations every day were something that I looked forward to, and you were always so open and honest and forthcoming, and I couldn't thank you more for every one of those days, and I'm so thrilled now that we're on the other end and that you're asking the questions.
Okay. Well, take care of yourself. We'll hope to see you soon.
Take care, Terry.
Yeah.
Terry, I really enjoyed the conversation with Gary Cohen. What a special guy he is, and what a history he's got with this organization.
Yeah, he's the best, man. I've done you. You know, in my 7 years there, you know, I knew Gary was big. I mean, but when you're around him and you see his work, the work that he does, the preparation that he does, it's amazing. And for me, he keeps those three guys together. I mean, Ron and Keith are, you know, they're very, very sharp and they have a lot to add, but Gary's the one who takes them in the directions that they want to go. And I will tell you, as we talked about in the interview, he has made Steve Gelbs into one of the best sideline reporters in the game.
Yeah, that was a good point you brought up, because they have really done a phenomenal job. And Steve Gelbs, as we had on this show recently, what a great job that he does. So that was a really good one, Terry. Really, really good one. Now it's time for the Tunnel of Towers Amazing Hero of the Week segment. Let's go to that right now.
I can almost see the dream I'm dreaming.
Hi, I'm Jesse Alexander, singer-songwriter from Nashville, and I co-wrote The Climb.
Every step I'm taking.
Someone say, hey, that song got me through my last rounds of chemo. I ran the last mile. I'm so grateful that I have a song that makes people feel any ounce of strength, hope, you know, just to take that next step.
3, 2, 1. 2,226 steps in this building. I guarantee you this, there's at least 2,226 stories of heroism that day.
Climb for the Fallen. The guys from my unit, the guys and girls I never met, and all the firefighters, Port Authority, and New York City police officers that were lost that day in 9/11.
I climb today for all of those that never got to come home. They never got a chance to climb back down on September 11, 2001.
We are here, we are not going away, and we're gonna run up those stairs in the glory of all those people. God bless you and God bless America.
There's always gonna be another mountain, always gonna wanna make it move.
I feel like Tunnel of Towers is my family away from my family. No matter what I need, when I need it, where I need it, I know that I have an extended family member from Tunnel of Towers that will make that happen for me.
It's the climb.
Stay strong, even when it's like you can't see how you're going to make that next step. How are you going to put one foot forward? Just know your own strength, because we are all so powerful and have way more strength inside of us than we can even imagine.
We'll have another T2T Amazing Hero segment on our next show. Terry, before we wrap it up, you'll be heading up to New York for the Queens Baseball Convention presented by SNY, taking place on December the 7th at the Four Points by Sheraton, located at 3368 Farrington Street in Queens, New York. It starts at 10 a.m. There'll be a special live baseball night in New York with you and your SNY colleagues. Is this the first time they've done this? Have you been there before? Tell us about the event.
Yeah, I went there last year. They asked me to come up last year, and I did a thing for SNY, and I did a little Q&A with all of the fans that were there. Tremendous attendance. I mean, it's, you know, here it is maybe three, four miles from the ballpark. So, you know, Mets fans come out in droves. It's a fun event. There's players there. There's, you know, memorabilia stands and Mets gear for sale. And it's a very, very fun day. And I look forward to going back this year.
Excellent. For those who want more information on it, just go to queensbaseballconvention.com. Once again, presented by SNY, and Terry will be there on December the 7th. And Terry, we have one show left, and we'll be taking a break for the Thanksgiving holiday. It's the holiday where we give thanks. And Terry, I have to say to you personally, my thanks this year is being able to do this show with you. I want to wish you and your family a very happy Thanksgiving, Terry.
Thank you, John. Be safe, travel safe, and happy Thanksgiving.
Thank you. We will be back for a final show of 2024 in just a few weeks. So for Terry Collins, this is John Arezzi. Have a great Thanksgiving, everyone.